Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Michael Luo, executive editor at The New Yorker, and we're talking about his monumental new book, Strangers in the Land, Exclusion, Belonging, and the Epic Story of the Chinese in America. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
This is indeed an epic history. It was amazing to read. I knew a few things about the Chinese early experience in America. I didn't know most of it. And this really was an incredible job of research. Talk to me about first of all, why you decided to write this history. And then talk to me about the process of digging up the information, especially in the early 19th century parts of the book. It was just incredible.
Yeah, the story of why I decided to embark on this book. There's kind of an immediate impetus, which was I signed the contract to write this book in the summer of 2021, which is a few months after the Atlanta spa attacks. That this was during the pandemic. There was this surge in violence against Asian Americans.
Oh yeah.
There was this horrific attack where several Korean immigrant women were killed by a white man, and you know, just a horrifying moment. And I wrote a piece for The New Yorker shortly after that that examined some of this history. But there's the story of the book, and the kind of journey to the book started a few years earlier. There was a moment that happened to me on the street in New York on the Upper East Side in the fall of 2016. This woman, my family and a few other friends of ours, all Asian American, were standing on the sidewalk on a Sunday after church, and a woman brushed past us and muttered to us, kind of spat out to us, go back to China. She was annoyed that we were blocking the sidewalk, and I didn't turn the other cheek, even though it was after church, and abandoned my younger daughter in her stroller and sprinted after and confronted her, and we ended up in this kind of back and forth, and she screamed at me, go back to your effing country down the block, and I didn't know how to respond. The adrenaline's pumping, and I yelled. I was born in this country. It was this very pathetic feeling response at the time. And I ended up writing a piece for the New York Times, where I worked at the time, that I ended up running on the front page about this feeling of otherizing that a lot of Asian Americans feel. And I wrote about my kids and this kind of sadness that I felt this. As I walked away that day of wondering whether they would ever feel like they truly belonged in this country, even though they're two generations removed from my parents' immigrant experience. And so that experience had stayed with me. And I remember in the days after that, the weeks after that, that piece ended up getting a lot of attention. And I was doing a lot of interviews like this one, actually, TV interviews, radio interviews, panel conversations. And I felt a little bit of an imposter syndrome. I was just somebody who had this insult flung at them, and then I wrote about it, I had a platform. But actually, when I was talking about, I was kind of a spokesperson for Asian Americans. I felt like I realized I didn't really know a lot of the context and history, and that's stayed with me, and that's. And then the pandemic happened, and so I decided to go and write 160,000 words book in response to this woman, and maybe I could hand it to her if I ever saw her again.
It's an incredible history in the detail that you dug up. Why did Chinese immigrants first start to come to the United States in the sort of late mid to late 1800s?
Yeah, the book begins with the gold rush, and that was, as you probably know, a global migration to the West Coast, and it was there is a story that is passed down in Chinese lore of a merchant who happened to be in America or in that 1848 time when gold was discovered, and the story is that he went into the foothills of the Sierra Nevada and wrote home about it, and there was a fellow villager who told others about it and set off across the Pacific themselves, and that this started this kind of escalator, I guess, of people from going back and forth across the Pacific. It's a trans-Pacific story, and so that really was the start. And it was I write about how that was up to that point, you know, obviously the issue of slavery and what to do about enslaved, you know, black people who were, and the sectional tensions that were erupting between the North and the South was consuming the East Coast or the Eastern Seaboard, and that issue continued to fester and obviously escalate. And but on the a little bit lesser known is on the West Coast, there was this extraordinary experiment in multiracial democracy that was unfolding, because there were Chinese immigrants, there were these Hispanic Mexican settlers who were in California. They were called Californios. There were indigenous people, there were formerly enslaved black Americans, and all kind of descending on California. And this was this remarkable test for our democracy. And the story of my book is how we responded to that test. The summary is that we didn't do particularly well.
No, we didn't. And I think the really sobering thing is, we're seeing that sort of white supremacist attitude playing out today. Mm. It's the same story, and it's the same amount of violence too. Getting back to the earliest Chinese immigrants to America and to the West Coast, the vast majority of them came from only four counties.
Yeah, there is this in southeastern China, in Guangdong Province. There's this place called that in Chinese it's called the Siyi, and it translates to four counties. It's just this region near the Pearl River Delta, and for some reason this little parcel of land the size of Connecticut supplied the vast majority of immigrants to America, Chinese immigrants to America, and it's a little bit of a historical puzzle of why that was. You know, there was there were obviously factors of there was violence going on. There was cultural there was conflict going on in that part of the China. There was some economic factors going on, but historians think that actually one of the major factors is that this part of China was accustomed to interacting, a little bit more accustomed than other parts of China with interacting with the West, because of the trading port of Hong Kong and Canton that were nearby. And so for whatever reason, the vast majority of these immigrants were coming from this little parcel in southeastern China.
Now, most of them were landing in San Francisco, right?
Yes, San Francisco and up and they made their way up and down the West Coast. This was really a Western. My book. It's like basically this is a country Western story. This is the making of the American West.
Now it's fascinating to read the terms that the white Americans had for the Chinese. Like they were called the Celestials. And there were other names that came on. So they land in San Francisco. Where do they go from there? They go out to the mines in their hopes that they're going to strike it rich and send the money back home.
Yeah, that this is this is kind of the initial story is in kind of California mine country, and outside of Sacramento, and when the mining started to dry up in the 1850s, early 1860s, and then they're starting to spread out into other parts of the state, and the other thing that's happening is as violence and against the Chinese started to rise in these more rural parts of the state, they ended up retreating back to San Francisco and this Chinese quarter there for safety. But there are Chinese communities that that developed in all kinds of places, Seattle, Tacoma, Los Angeles, San Diego. My book talks about Wyoming territory. There's a famous horrific event that happened in this place called Rock Springs, Wyoming, where 28 Chinese miners were, or Chinese residents of Rock Springs were killed by white miners. Up and down the West Coast.
It's fascinating because they're the victims of the often the economic health of America. When things would go wrong, and there were several times when there was like sort of a depression, and then the Irish aren't unemployed, or the Italians, but mostly the Irish, then all of a sudden it becomes the anti-Chinese, anti-coolism, as it was called, and they become victimized. Sometimes it's horrific sort of riots where just a large number of Chinese residents were killed. But as long as that they were economically useful, it's like the building of the railroad came along and all of a sudden, wow, the Chinese are really good. And we can use them. As long as they could be victimized like that, there was less violence.
Yeah, there was this period. The railroad, which was in the 1860s, there was this period after the completion of the railroad, when there might have been a window that they could have found more broad acceptance, but that quickly was extinguished. You mentioned the economic factors. There was in the 1870s there was this economic depression that really blanketed the entire country, and they actually called this the Great Depression before the Great Depression that is more familiar to us in the 1930s. And that was when the anti-Chinese movement really started to take off. And there was this labor movement that really started to take root. This is the and it was, this is kind of the foundation of the modern labor movement, really. And it's interesting because it was this kind of populist movement, and they, part of their ideology was railing against monopolies and the corporate sort of powers. But at the heart of it was this anti-Chinese sentiment scapegoated the Chinese.
It was like they needed a scapegoat, even though they seemed like the other aspects of their organization seemed online. The Chinese as scapegoat was just the way that they would characterize Chinese. It was phenomenally as the other. They would never assimilate. They would never speak our language. Yeah. It's a debauched culture. They're dirty, unclean, heathens. Yet you also have in your book, everybody who ever like had them as working in their homes, praise them to high heavens, but everybody would run short of giving them citizenship.
I think the there is this, I think there's the, it's a good lesson for today is, the Chinese, when they're kind of handled in the realm of politics, are handled at this kind of level of abstraction. And, what I'm trying to do in the book is tell their human stories.
Yeah.
And when you mentioned, you know, white people who got to know Chinese, as whether as like their domestic household servants or whether as employees and built relationships with them, you know, saw them in some cases, in many cases, as more than abstractions. You mentioned the coolie phenomenon. That's actually really interesting because it was the idea, and this was an inaccurate perception, that the Chinese were coming here against their will,
right,
working under these oppressive coolie contracts. And it was interesting because politicians took on this cause and adopted the language of anti-slavery and used it to target the Chinese, saying that, you know, this kind of anti-Chinese movement was actually a movement in defense of free labor. And it was just this way of twisting these principles of, you know, these ideals that, that America was founded on, stood for, that became, you know, this racist movement. It's also, it helps explain a little bit of how both parties, I mean, this just keep in mind at this point, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln,
right,
and, you know, freed the slaves, and Democrats at this point, their political redoubt was in the South. And this was this kind of period in the late 19th century when they were throwing out the shackles of Reconstruction and vanquishing Reconstruction in the South. And so it made sense how the Democrats could adopt this anti-Chinese sentiment as part of the core of their party. But the what happened with Republicans is Republicans adopted this anti-coolie. You see in these speeches, you see some of that ideology being shape-shifting and being twisted and distorted. And really what happened was the country was very closely divided, polarized. It's very much like it was today. And both parties recognized that they needed the West Coast in order to achieve, you know, political supremacy, to win the presidency, win Congress. And the Chinese became convenient political scapegoats. And there was kind of this contest of who could be uglier and harsher and tougher on the Chinese. And that really helps to explain how it was that this West Coast phenomenon became a national kind of political consensus. And the Chinese Exclusion Act was, which banned the immigration of Chinese laborers into the country in 1882, came about.
It's sobering that it's not until Lyndon Johnson and the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 that the situation starts to normalize.
Yeah, that's fascinating, right?
No, it's depressing. I'm old enough that I lived through Johnson, and to realize that it took that frickin' long.
Yeah. So the Chinese Exclusion Act was formally repealed during World War II, when China and the United States found themselves allies,
right,
in the war against, in the Pacific War against Japan. And it was just this realization that there are millions of Chinese soldiers who were dying fighting the Japanese as allies of the United States, and it was just embarrassing that you know, effectively Chinese immigration was closed off. And so, but they lifted it when they repealed it, they only allowed in this very modest number, like 109 or something like that. Chinese were this, that was the size of the Chinese quota. And so as you alluded to, it wasn't until 1965 when Chinese and other Asian immigrants really were placed on equal footing with other immigrant groups. And and the doors were thrown open for Chinese and other Asian immigration. The thing that I write about in the book that's also really important to keep in mind is that actually came about a little bit by accident. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 prioritizes two things: family reunification and skills-based allocations. People with special skills and education were prioritized in immigration, and the supporters of the bill and the advocates for it emphasized that it wasn't going to change the demographics of the country tremendously. They basically reasoned that, oh, this is prioritizing family reunification, so we have certain number of different groups in this country, and so they're all going to bring, you know, their families, and it'll be remain roughly the same. There's almost a math mistake. They underestimated the exponential power of family reunification, and that's why Asian immigrants are, you know, the fastest growing group in the United States, and are projected. I think Asian immigrants are projected a few decades in a not too distant future are projected to be the largest immigrant group in the United States.
Did you also learn?
And that happened by accident. It wasn't. If they knew, if the people who passed this legislation knew that this was going to happen, it wouldn't have passed. Johnson actually, when he signed the bill, emphasized this is not a revolutionary bill. He was trying to offer that reassurance to people.
Well, like from the beginning, it was like the Chinese are going to swarm and take over America. I mean, there was that portrayal. Most of the early immigrants to America, they were mostly male, right?
Yeah, this is this immigration is a overwhelmingly male immigration. Chinese women who came, wives and that kind of thing. There is a really important law that passed in 1875 called the Page Act, which was like precursor to the Chinese Exclusion Act that barred women coming for lewd and immoral purposes.
Right.
And this was this kind of irrational fear of Chinese prostitution that led to the Page Act, and it effectively closed off immigration of Chinese women. Because even if you were a wife, it was, you weren't coming as a prostitute. It was very hard to prove that to these immigration inspectors.
Did you learn? We only have a few minutes left. Did you learn a lot about your family's history too by doing this, writing this book?
So my history, it's interesting. So my history is not primarily in this book. My parents came in 1965. They're part of that post 1965 migration, and there are many Chinese Americans who can trace their family histories back five generations,
right,
particularly in San Francisco and on the West Coast. When I've done events, there've been a variety of different types of audiences, and in San Francisco, I asked, you know, how many people here can trace their families back five generations, and many people raised their hands, and which is incredibly moving, I think, when you think about this book, because yes, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of horrific stuff that happened, but the Chinese, as the protagonists of the book, were persisted, and it's a story of resilience and hope in the end, and I didn't know a lot of this history. I was not aware of it. And, you know, when you think about it, it feels, you know, before I set out to write this book, it felt kind of different. Like it wasn't my history, I thought. They spoke Cantonese or Toisanese or Hakka, these dialects that my family did not speak. You know, these men wore queues and these kind of braids that were, male subjects in the Qing Dynasty War. But I found when I read their stories and I immersed myself, this kinship with these people, that these were the first Asian immigrants to the United States. And the story of being strangers in the land is something I think that still resonates with a lot of Asian Americans today.
It was amazing to read about when the Chinese finally started to emigrate east in America
yep.
and ended up in places like Chicago or New
yep.
York or Boston. And
yep.
that was a change up in their situation. It seemed like, although the racist policies followed them.
Yes. A lot of people came east as a way of escaping the
violence,
hostilities
yeah.
on the West Coast. And, you know, New York Chinatown in particular really started to take off in the 1870s and 1880s. And it's actually just kind of fascinating. You would find these newspaper articles of, you know, the New York Times or other newspapers where reporters would kind of greet people
yeah.
getting off, Chinese immigrants getting off of these trains coming from the West Coast and asking them why they came. And
well, it was like the exotic.
Yeah.
Michael, we're completely out of time. I'm sorry. Yeah. Again, there's so much in this book. This is a huge history. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Michael Luo, executive editor at The New Yorker, and we've been talking about his new book. I cannot recommend this history enough. It's really a great and well-written history. Strangers in the Land, Exclusion, Belonging, and the Epic Story of the Chinese in America. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.